the fourth case, which will be taken on the brief, Lebowski versus Ashcroft. And then the court will proceed to the fifth case, Smith versus the City of Hammond. Mr. Grimes.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Douglas Grimes, and I represent the appellant in this case. And the question here on appeal is whether the trial court abused its discretion by denying the motion for preliminary injunction. Our belief is that the court did abuse its discretion, and we believe that it did so by determining that the appellant had an adequate remedy at law.
Mr. Grimes,
yes.
Unless I missed it somehow, I don't think that you responded at all to the argument that Judge Harkin enjoys absolute immunity for acts he takes in his official capacity. How do you respond to this?
Well, with regard to the acts taken by Judge Harkin, there's a separation here. There were two plaintiffs originally. Warren, who was the criminal defendant, who had engaged the bail agent to post a surety bond for her. In terms of Harkin's actions as related to Warren, we are not addressing that issue because Warren is no longer in the case and got out shortly before the appeal was filed. With regard to the bail agent, that issue surrounds the question of the propriety of the declaratory judgment. In this particular case, our position was that in this case, we did not allege or seek relief of declaratory judgment because we were seeking damages for past behavior.
I'm missing something. Judges have absolute immunity from suits against them in their official capacity, right?
Yes, except in certain situations dealing with, unless there is one is seeking a declaratory judgment. That is, seeking a declaration of that party's rights. In this particular case, we did not seek declaratory relief in the original complaint, and that is the basis for the argument that we could not sue Judge Harkin. However, declaratory judgment was not available in our thinking at the time because we were seeking damages that had already accrued, not to prevent damages that would accrue in the future. And so that is why the argument that we could not sue Judge Harkin arose. And we addressed that in our brief, in our reply brief, at page 2, under argument B, injunctive relief was available against all of the defendants, including Judge Harkin. And I won't read that for you, but I'll just point this out. The bulk of the damages in this particular case accrued prior to filing of the suit. And the case that we cited, Hoagie Wrecker Service, Inc. versus City of Fort Wayne, declaratory judgment is inappropriate to adjudicate past conduct. This conduct began back in 1996 or 1997. As we understand it, a declaration of rights will not address Smith's substantial claim for accrued damages. So therefore, we did not talk about declaratory judgment in the original complaint. Because most of Smith's damages...
Who do you want the damages from?
I'm sorry, Judge?
Who do you want to pay the damages?
We want the municipality, the City of Hammond, to pay the damages. It is the Hammond City Court. And Judge Rodner, I simply refer you to page 2 of our reply brief, where we attempt to discuss the issue that you have raised in the context of the ability to bring suit against Judge Harkin.
I, forgive me, Mr. Grimes, but I really am having a terrible time following your argument.
I can tell. Let me just try to address your argument, your concern.
Yeah.
In Smith's prayer for relief, seeking a temporary restraining order and a preliminary injunction under Section 1983,
mm-hmm.
under the facts of this case, the nature and relief sought declaratory judgment was unavailable. In other words, declaratory judgment was unavailable, in our view, because summary judgment is designed to avoid avoidable damages.
Look, I don't want to seem like a simpleton, but...
Well, certainly, I don't...
No, really.
No.
But it seems to me that Judge Harkin enjoys absolute immunity for the acts he takes in his official capacity. Now, these were acts he did in his official capacity. Am I wrong?
Well, there are two sets of acts. One, you have the Warren Act, who was the criminal defendant that the bail agent sought
to
postpone.
But we're not worrying about that.
Okay.
Right? Right now.
I don't agree that Judge Harkin had the absolute immunity to violate the rights of any party. I don't agree with that. I don't agree with that.
Okay.
But within the context of declaratory judgment is my point, that the Declaratory Judgment Act is designed to avoid accrual of avoidable damages. And what we were saying with regard to Judge Harkin was, these damages that we're talking about are forward-looking. That is what our contention was. And hopefully, a review of Section B of our reply brief will make it clear, and I'm sure that I'm not doing as good a job as I should in trying to make it clear at this point. But our point is that the damages in this case made declaratory judgment initially, in our view, unavailable because they dealt with past damages. Declaratory judgment is prospective in nature. It seeks to avoid the accrual of future damages by virtue of some wrongful act that are currently threatened. That is my understanding of it.
Well, why don't we just rely on the briefs and your argument to date on that issue, Mr. Grimes, and go on to
thank you, Judge.
The other points.
I'm afraid to ask you another question.
Well,
go ahead.
No, you're absolutely correct. No, my other question is this. What is the source of Smith's 14th Amendment right to render bail services in all the courts of Indiana?
His bail license issued by the state of Indiana, which can only be revoked for cause. In this particular case, the Hammond City Court has a policy that totally excludes bail agents utilization of their license to post surety bonds in the Hammond City Court. As a result, their property...
Is your complaint that this judge, Judge Harkin, refuses to accept the bond company or whatever?
I'm sorry, Judge.
That Judge Harkin refuses to accept a surety bond. Is that your complaint?
That's part of it, yes. From licensed bail agents.
Well, it wouldn't make any difference whether the damages were collected from him or from his court, right?
Well,
suppose you didn't like our decision, case, and you couldn't sue us for damages, but neither could you sue the Seventh Circuit for the damages caused by our judicial ruling. So if he was acting within his judicial capacity when he said no bail bond, whatever it is, then that you couldn't get damages for that.
Our suit,
from anybody.
First of all, we were at the very beginning of the process. Our suit alleges that the city of Hammond, the clerk, and the police chief were the municipality that gave rise to the creation of the city court. But our position with regard to damages, we're not seeking damages from Judge Harkin. We are seeking damages from the city of Hammond.
Yes, I know. But as I say, you can't get around judicial immunity by suing the judge's employer.
Well,
let me ask you a different question, though.
Sure.
Because one of the points the government makes is that you're actually not, your client doesn't want to post a $6,800 bond. He just wants to post a bond for the the 10% cash deposit. Is that correct?
No, it's not. The issue there, Judge, is that the total bail in this case was $6,800.
Right.
The court will only accept a 10% cash deposit. It will not accept that deposit by surety.
Yes, but that's what I thought. And I thought you said it, I was wrong. That your client wants to provide a bond for $680, not for $6,800.
No, for $6,800 because that's the 10% that the court requires.
$680 is 10%.
That's what the court is requiring. The 680.
So the bond would be a bond for $680.
No, the bail was $6,800.
But what will the bond say? What will the bond say?
The bond would be for
what
the.
What will Smith guarantee to the court in the event that the defendant skips?
Right. Smith would guarantee, one, to the extent that he could, his appearance. Two, that if he didn't appear, then the court would have the could. Fees and he would forfeit the entire amount of the bail.
$6,800. Okay.
And the bond premium was 10% of the bail. But the issue here is that Mr. Smith was simply unable to practice his profession.
Right. I
by virtue of the policy of the Hammond City Court. Our position is that the court's finding that Mr. Smith had an adequate remedy at law, we found that to be faulty in part because it was difficult, if not impossible, to calculate his damages because of the nature of the business that he's engaged in. Number one, there is no client list where he finds... My time is up.
Thank you, Mr. Graham. Mr. Weigel.
Good morning, Your Honors. If it please the court. The first problem is most of the, if you look at the verified complaint in this case, most all damages are prospective, and counsel has conceded that Ms. Warren is no longer a party here. And there is no allegation that declaratory relief was unavailable in this complaint, number one. And Hodges v. Mangano, you've held in 2002, injunctive relief can't be granted against a judicial actor unless the declaratory decree was violated or declaratory relief was unavailable or unless the judge's conduct was clearly excessive. And there haven't been any allegations to get around that. 42 U.S.C. Section 1983 explicitly says you can't get declaratory judgment against a state court officer while acting within his jurisdiction. The Rooker-Feldman Doctrine, and I've said this in the brief, also states that you can't assail a state court judgment even when it implicates constitutional issues. Now, with regard to the bond, the allegations in the verified complaint at number 14 lists what is described or what are described as cash bonds. Now, if you look at the statute, there's only one place you see cash bonds, and those are 10% cash bonds that the court can issue. And that would be 35, 33, 8, 3.2, 2. Require the defendant to execute a bail bond by depositing cash or securities with the clerk of the court in an amount not less than 10% of the bail. So the plaintiff is alleging that's what they did. However, when you read on and you get to the allegations of 26, 27, 28, and 29, the prefatory allegations in each of those paragraphs say, defendant's policy requiring all criminal defendants to post cash bonds in the full amount of the bail caused deprivation of the rights. Well, you can't have it both ways. If you're saying it's a cash bond and you're familiar with the statute, it's a cash bond. If the cash bond was $6,800, that means the bail was $68,000. So what's going on here, I think, is these bondsmen have an interest in equating the bond with the bail so that the prospective client is confronted with a choice, which is either pay the $6,800 in cash to the court or pay me $680. When the truth of the matter is, the real choice is that the defendant has a choice of paying the $680 to the bondsman or $680 to the clerk of the court. If he pays it to the clerk of the court and shows up, he gets it back subject to a $50 administrative fee and some fines that may be withdrawn from that. That is not good for bondsmen because any self-respecting defendant wants his $680 back. At least I would. So there's an equation here between bail and cash bond that is really inappropriate. Now, the district court didn't decide this case on jurisdiction, and we think the case should be decided on jurisdiction. This should not have been filed in the U.S. District Court. If the bail was excessive, they had a right under the state statute in Indiana to go ahead and ask to lower the bail, and if that was refused, then they could file a petition for habeas corpus. So they had these remedies available to them, which they did not avail themselves of. The Fifth Amendment argument was waived.
What you're saying, if I understand you, is that if a cash bond is permitted by a judge, defendants will always take that over paying the same amount as a premium.
I would think so, Your Honor.
So the bonds people, the people like Smith, their business is in cases where the judge is not willing to permit a cash bond. Is that what happens?
That is correct.
The higher risk.
I agree. You see most of the bond and felony cases in our area instead of the misdemeanor cases in the city courts for that reason. I don't think the mere fact that a bail license is a property interest under the 14th Amendment, if it is, and I'm not conceding that it is, it may very well be, doesn't mean that the gentleman who has the license has a right to some sort of income in the sense of being a quasi-judicial officer who can go in there and say, look, you must give me this bond. The fact of the matter is most of the people who post the cash bonds show up. So, and by the way, this is not the first time Mr. Smith has challenged the statute. He's very familiar with it. Our Supreme Court in the year 2002, and I didn't cite this in the brief, 766 Northeast 2nd, 707, found that the bail statute was constitutional, that the court did have the right to pledge any of those various different types of bonds, and it was not a violation of the 14th Amendment. So we're back here again apparently arguing now that the policy of Judge Harkin really equates to having this constitutional statute unconstitutionally applied. Well, the problem with that is we have another case in Indiana, Mott versus the state of Indiana, and that's in my brief, which says that the only measure here is whether the city court judge abuses his or her discretion. So they held that the court does have discretion under the statute, so it can't be unconstitutionally applied either. That's all I have, unless you have questions.
Okay.
Thank you.
Mr. Grimes, your time has expired, but you may have 1 minute if you have something in rebuttal.
First of all, the cases discussed by counsel, they were totally different issues. The 14th Amendment claim in this case has never been adjudicated any place that we're aware of. The bondsman in this case is not saying he has a right to income. He has a right to make a living and use his license. That's why he got his license.
Do you think it's improper for a judge to allow a defendant to post a cash bond?
No. The statute permits it. The problem, Judge, is that the only form of bond that the Hammond City Court and others increasingly are going to is cash. And the bail agent has the right to make a living. He's authorized by the state to do this. And he is being totally excluded. His right to make a living in his chosen profession is being denied not by state law, but by the courts. And he has the right to make a living. In terms of the type of bond, the 10% or the surety, there's no hearing conducted to determine what type of bond should we have in a case like this. There is no hearing. There is a flat rule, 10% cash. The other part about the $50 administrative fee, typically the defendant gets very little of his money back because of the various programs that the court forces him to go through, and therefore he gets no money back, or his money is used to pay lawyers that are made available by the court. So the defendant doesn't get his money back. He is a captive. The court and the personnel say, look, this is what our rule is. You can't get to a bondsman. The bondsman never gets to see or have the opportunity to get the business. And in our complaint, we are raising issues of monopolistic practices by the state, where they're denying people the right to make a living and use their license and depriving them of their property.
Thank you, Mr. Grimes. Thank you, Mr. Clark. The case is taken under advisement. The court will stand in recess.